Hello.
Good morning. Good morning, Leonie. How are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Andy. I don't think I've spoken to you since last year.
Good heavens. It seems like ages ago. And I have to say, it's been an aching wait, but I'm glad we're back.
I think Malcolm may be on site.
Yeah, I think he might have preferred to be with other people.
Well, let's hope he joins us having a sort of had his morning coffee. I'm just going to invite Graham here. Graham, are you there actually?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, good morning. How are you? Happy New Year.
Yeah, happy New Year to you too. So, sorry, I had a meeting, pre-breakfast meeting.
It's interesting. I mean, I thought 7 a.m. was early, but this is and a feline affirmation as well.
Absolutely. She's very vocal this morning, isn't she?
I'm so
Perhaps
glad.
it's because I've been away, so she's very happy to see me.
She's
Perhaps
singing.
it's
Yes.
Actually, she's shouting for her breakfast, so I've decided to shut her up by giving her breakfast.
There's got
And
to be no
you'll notice
distractions.
the singing has stopped.
Oh, well, I was hoping she might, in the absence of Mal, I was hoping we might get sort of a feline seat at the board, so to speak, but I hope Mal joins us in a bit. So, we've had three in speeches from Reform UK, the Lib Dems, and Labour. In the inauguration of the new year, Reform UK appear to be aping Labour's economic policy to some extent. It looks as if we're looking at an election of the second half of 2023. Ed Davey is seeking to introduce a bill to bring it forward. What are our impressions of how these three eminent parties did their thing? Graham, do you want to
Well,
lead off since Leonie is, I won't say partisan, but you know, it's.
I am partisan. Very partisan.
Blindly.
It's my job to be partisan, Andy.
And no reform.
Go on, Graham. What do you reckon? When's the election going to be? Have you got a crystal ball?
No.
I could be really rude and
No.
say, have you got a pair of crystal balls? But that sounds just too rude, really, for this time in the morning, I think.
Yeah, I think I listened to the speech, I think obviously he expected to be quite early rather than very late. And the best time for winning is sort of it is autumn, isn't it? I think he'll go for the autumn. He will hang on as long as he can, I think, because he knows.
January 25, then.
Well, no, he said it's this year, hasn't he?
No, but the longest he really could hang on for would be January 25.
So Starmer's speech was, I thought, very as it was meant to be, reassuring, as the steady candidate, the reliable candidate, the one you can trust, back to standards and so on. And capable, economically capable, and so on. So I think it probably will work. I think it's that's obviously what it's doing, rather than making controversial policy. But it may backfire if Sunak finds a way to put the wedge in.
This was, I think he warned us of this possibility in the speech, didn't he? Reform UK, according to the Tory chair, are going to facilitate Labour's ascent. And again, it strikes me that some of their key policies are sort of versions, through no doubt through very, very different means, in proposal of Starmer's sort of big 5-point agenda, which itself has gone through many modifications in recent months. Perhaps due to sobering economic circumstances. What do you think the impact of Richard Tice is likely to be on those sort of red wall areas, particularly who were hankering for something that they thought wasn't Labour?
Well, I've seen some polls in London, forget the red wall areas, where it shows it's Reform, the party name, isn't it? I think now it's hard to keep track. It changes all the time. And apparently Farage has got some sort of deal where if he wants to get involved, he can. He's got some sort of shareholder. element of responsibility. But they're polling in London at 10%. Now, if they poll at 10% next May, when we definitely have the Assembly and mayoral election, firstly, that probably is very good news for Sadiq Khan in the mayoral election, because they will predominantly take votes from the Tories. So that would probably scupper much of a chance for Susan Hall. But it would mean that they would definitely get at least one seat, if not two, on the Assembly, because 10% takes you over the 5% threshold. We have a threshold, very sensibly, we have a threshold so that you can't just get a party that's got 1% of the vote elected into the Assembly. And I jolly well wish that some of the places like Israel, the Knesset, they should have a threshold. And then some of these mad parties that get 1% of the vote that are currently controlling Netanyahu and controlling the disastrous Likud-led government's policies on everything from what's going on in Gaza to settlement in the West Bank. And a threshold would get rid of all of that, because they just wouldn't get over a 5% threshold, because they get these very, very tiny percentages. But you know, the scary thing for us would be, oh my goodness, will we have people from Reform on the Assembly? I think elsewhere it would probably have the same impact. It might take enough votes off the Conservatives in the, I don't know, are we calling them Red Wall or Blue Wall? It should be Blue Wall now, shouldn't it? Because they're all currently blue seats. It could take enough votes off the Conservative candidates for Labour to do extremely well and take loads of those seats. So, I mean, when you hear these things sort of saying, oh, you know, the polling is showing that, you know, there could be Labour victories in unlikely places, that would be why, because, you know, it tends to be that they get about 80% of their votes from people who otherwise might vote Conservative and 20% of their votes from people who might otherwise vote Labour. They obviously also get some votes from people who normally wouldn't vote at all. So, yeah, it could be quite consequential.
Does this seem to stem as agenda somewhat?
I'm sorry, gosh, I completely missed that. Your reproduction is terrible.
It is, yeah. How does Standard react to the presence of Reform UK? How does the political world react to it? Because the press career rests firm rather than Ed Dundee down in Guildford.
I'm really struggling, Andy. I can catch everything that Graham is saying, so I don't think it is my end.
Yeah. I think it's selling this red pan. It's very iffy. I need to buy a new one. As I say, the regular one normally looks fine, but for some reason, the radio function on it wasn't working at all this morning. I tried it every which way. So sorry about that. So how does Reform UK affect the political landscape and the campaigning of the other parties? I note, for example, of the press corps is left to them insofar as the influential is, rather than Ed Dundee there in Guildford.
How do I think the existence of Reform UK should affect the planning of campaigns by other parties?
Yes, thank you.
Well, I don't think it should. I mean, I think, you know, you should put forward your own positive platform for change if you're Labour or if you're Liberal Democrat. I really think that sort of tacking around because of Reform UK is a mistake. And in any case, I, you know, as I said, probably 80% of their votes would come from the Conservatives. And we certainly know the Conservatives have been tacking around with their policy offering to try and win over voters who are very concerned about migration, for example, and things like that. But I don't think for the Liberal Democrats or Labour it makes any sense at all to try and alter their sort of policy positions, because I just don't think, I think it would completely undermine the sort of integrity of the messaging of those parties, because they don't really play to that audience, do they? And if they started to, it'd just be very obvious that they were packing for electoral profit. And I think a lot of people really don't like that.
Yeah, I agree. It's very much the impressions that the parties are giving. Where journalists keep complaining that they're not being very specific in the policy. But I think that's right, because it's the impressions that are overriding the specific policies. Analysis of policies is not very common. It's far more the impressions. I think also that the general population is probably wised up a bit about the social media. So there's some very interesting research come out by the person who named emotional quotient compared to intelligence quotient. So, and he's been following for the last 20 years the change in intelligence, IQ against EQ. And it's very clear, he says, the intelligence IQ is going up, but EQ is going down. And the clear reason is the technology, the social media technology, which is an extremely interesting piece of information.
It's just been hacked in sort of brand terms, isn't it, in terms of how people react to a little insight because for an additional one.
Well, it explains, you know, how people talk to each other, including in Parliament. And it does explain this aggressiveness, the increase in aggressiveness. The emotional quotient means that their empathy is going down. So people don't give a fig what other people feel or think. Well, I don't know what the question was there, but...
I'm just wondering if you could just notice the way this research is. It sounds fascinating.
Well, it's because he's been following the IQ and EQ for 20 years. And he's fairly categorical that it's the technology that's the reason. For the wider issue, it relates to perception of global warming and understanding comprehension of global warming, because it's apparent that the majority don't actually comprehend that it's not a disaster coming, it's extinction that's coming. They can't distinguish the two.
You were just saying, should political parties tack towards trying to win votes from Reform UK? And then we'd moved on with Graham talking about, I saw that as well, about this emotional quotient and that people spend... Because they're online and they're communicating more, it's like the demise of the phone call. People don't give each other a ring anymore. They send each other a WhatsApp message. If they're very quaint and old-fashioned, even a text message, or they send an email. So it's all sort of electronic communication via devices, but they don't actually ring up people and speak to them. So it's this whole sort of distancing thing that's happened. I think that's the problem. And I don't think it's just something that affects people in Parliament. I think it affects loads of people everywhere.
That's right.
It's a range of things as well. And I think it's certainly... All struck me recently that the emotional quotient of the rulers, particularly those on the sort of the soft left, but really it affects generally, is significantly lower. You used to have leaders who were much more adept at actually connecting with the nation as a whole. Thatcher and Blair, I think, were two outstanding examples of that in their very different ways, obviously. What we've had recently is kind of almost a declaration of war over the last decade by the urban metropolitan elite, talking down to the rest of the country. We saw it in the Brexit debate. We saw it in the people were too stupid to see through the propaganda and didn't know what they were voting for. We've seen it in the emergence of the way the environmental issue has been sold in many ways is like that. And we've now seen it in terms of trans rights, where people it's everyday lives that they're being told are not good enough, and that we, the clever people in the cities and in the seats of power, know better than you about what your lives are like, and you should jolly well live your lives the way we tell you to live your lives. And in declaring that war, the complete lack of recognition that most of those who are in that position tend to be quite analytical in their thinking, and to make their minds up based on what they see as an analysis of the facts, however accurate they may be, while recognizing that for the majority of the population just isn't like that. The majority of the population is driven by a small majority, but a majority nonetheless is driven by gut feelings, is driven by empathy, will respond far more to whether the person they're talking to them seems to be on their wavelength and to understand their lives and their challenges. And the Tories are obviously massively in difficulties with this over the having such a rich prime minister. No problem in as such of having, I think, the richest prime minister in history. But when it comes to then debates like, well, we'll cut inheritance tax for the top 7% of people, but we can't afford to pay doctors or the like, then clearly that is a jar with people. And what I think we're seeing this week in the re-emergence or proper place of the post office scandal in public thinking after the Mr. Bates versus the post office, absolutely gripping watching. Carlos and I just watched it in a single binge. It was the equivalent of an unputdownable book. Those giving the impression that the present government is just not motivated by the same things as normal people, and the PPE scandal and so on all adds to that. While on the other hand, Labour, Starmer has gone some way towards dealing with this, but this dreadful talking down to people, which continues over Brexit and over the environment, and not recognizing, and Just Stop Oil is a very good example of this, of not recognizing that however strongly you might believe in something, if you treat people as if you think they are idiots and not as clever as you are, then you're very unlikely to win their hearts and minds. And I think the drop in emotional intelligence in our leaders on all sides of this is not just a matter of technology and things of that nature. It's a fundamental, maybe it's a secondary effect, but it has emerged, I think, because of this growing feeling of moral superiority and intellectual superiority over most people, and yet still expecting those people then to follow you with their hearts and minds.
It's not clearly in sort of sympathetic. It is actually an attitude of mind that perhaps is sympathetic.
Oh, Andy, can't
no idea anything. What you just said, Andy. I'm sorry.
No.
I'm really about this. I think I'm going to have to ask you guys just to carry on. I'll say a little bit more of them, but you can't hear me.
It's just.
But the point that Malcolm was talking about, the IQ is going up. So presumably there are the analytical faction is increasing.
There's no correlation between whether you approach the world in an emotive way or an analytical way and how good you are at actually doing it. There's no relationship between, as far as I'm aware anyway, there's no relationship between the intelligence as measured by intelligence tests, and that's a big question as to how valid that is for anything real in life, and the level. Yeah, there are some extraordinarily clever people who view the world, and I've had the privilege of working with many of them, who view the world through empathy and through values and through judgments. And in fact, you know, for a fully functioning society, you need both of those bases covered. You need people who are driven by a sense of fellow feeling and emotional connection with people, and you need those who are going to tell you, well, actually, this is probably what will work and what won't work. But it's not, you know, and again, almost this is a saying, giving the impression that intelligent people make their minds up based on the facts itself is an example of what I was talking about, the talking down to the majority of the population who are more empathetic in the way they reach the world. I'm not saying either is better or worse, they're both needed, but it is ironic to me that people who are highly analytical don't seem to be able to recognise this fairly basic idea that not everybody thinks the same way they do. You'd think people who are analytical would twig this and vary their behaviour accordingly, as some do. As I say, Blair and Thatcher were in their different ways were geniuses in that direction.
So if the intelligent people know that we're going extinct, and the emotional people don't want to recognize this and continue voting to go extinct, you don't think they're misguided?
I don't think you can divide.
You don't think they're misguided to go extinct?
You can't.
Well, one thing, and we must. Sorry, Leonie, just for a second. Are you saying that is not what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change very clearly does not say that we are heading for extinction. It says we're heading for very serious events here, but that it's only this ridiculous ICR 8.5, which suddenly went from being a 5% probability, and now the probability much less because of what we've already done, to being the central scenario. Yeah, the way out extreme scenario suddenly became the medium way, and that's a way. You know, so almost it's counterproductive to go to people and say this is the scale of change that's needed. You then create something where it is far more psychologically rewarding for them to disbelieve that. And there are many intelligent people who seriously criticise climate science. I think they're wrong, but they do so. But again, this kind of attitude towards that. You've got to bring people with you if you're going to do this, and just lecturing them on how stupid they are that they got taken in by the Leave campaign or whatever will have exactly the opposite effect from that, as we saw in the Brexit referendum. Yeah, before the actual campaign, there was a pretty small but looked fairly solid proportion in favour of remaining in the EU. But during the campaign, lots of people came out and talked down to, particularly to the urban, to the small town north, I think is the cliche that's used, but it was much wider than that. And as a result, people thought, well, if they're going to treat me like that, I don't really know what the issues are on Europe. I mean, who did? I certainly didn't. But if they're going to speak to me like that, I'm certainly not going to vote for what they want. And the complete boneheadedness in terms of emotional IQ of those who ran the Remain campaign and are still making this argument of not realising that the aim was to get people to vote for staying in the European Union, not to persuade people they were so stupid that they had to change their minds. And they lost sight of that, and they lost the referendum on the basis. And the same's happening with climate change.
That's the point of distinguishing between IQ and EQ, is that people are making decisions on a different basis. And the assumption is that IQ is persuaded by rational science.
That's a complete misreading, I'm afraid.
Well, the issue is whether it's a scientific fact that if you increase the CO2 in the atmosphere, we go extinct through overheating. That's right, the scientific fact.
That's not what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says.
I know it isn't, and then that's why it's mistaken, because it should be analysing the extinction point and the point of no return. In other words, how long do we have before we can change the climate?
So we're now saying that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change isn't clever enough to understand the issue.
Not at all. We didn't mention cleverness.
What are you saying then when you're saying that they're getting it wrong?
Well, we're assuming they have a high IQ.
No, I mean, that's the point I wanted to try and make, you guys. I think we're kind of going down a bit of a blind alley, because I think that everybody has a mixture of emotional intelligence and, if you like, sort of IQ measured analytical intelligence. It's just that our life experiences then help us mediate how we approach the world through both of those facets. And you can't say that people are either using their analytical brain or using their emotional brain, because everybody uses a mixture of the two all of the time. And actually, if you listen to some of the stuff that some of the people involved in Extinction Rebellion are saying, they're clearly not using their analytical brain. They are clearly using their emotional brain, and they talk a lot about there being no world for their children and no world for their grandchildren. And some of them will burst into tears when they're talking about it because they're so emotionally driven to be involved. And I don't know anyone involved in Just Stop Oil. Well, I may know someone involved in Just Stop Oil, but they've never told me that they are. But I know I have met several people who've been going to the Extinction Rebellion, various sort of protests. And they are incredibly emotional about it. They're not involved in the protests because they've conducted a full analysis and read every single one of the scientific papers that has been brought forward to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That's not how they're approaching it. So they're approaching the issue of climate change and the climate emergency in a very emotional way. And I think it's when you get a group, a problem is being approached by different groups who all come to the same conclusion, which is that actually, whatever you think about whether or not there's going to be an extinction event very soon, or whether you think there's just going to be runaway climate change if we don't change our behaviour, the bottom line is, I think, that almost everybody, the number of people who don't believe that we need to do something about addressing how we operate in the world, and not just in terms of our fossil fuel use, but also many other aspects of the way that we lead our lives, which have, you know, we're pretty filthy as, you know, if you look at us as animals, we've abused the world far more than any other animal that lives in it. The concept of leave only footprints is not one that most of us have followed at all. So thinking about how we lead our lives and how we change our lives. But then for those of us who are in responsible positions where we're thinking about what do we need to change in terms of how the government, whether that's local, regional, national, changes its approach and helps people move forward, you have to then start talking about mitigation and adaptation. And sometimes, yeah, that has to involve saying, yeah, we're going to make a big change, but then we're going to help you towards that change. And I would give you as a very obvious example at the London-wide level, the ULEZ, the ultra-low emission zone, which the original decision was to implement it all from 2020, going out, over quite a large area. And that isn't how it came in. It came in much more gradually. It started with the T charge, then it started in central London, then it came to inner London, now it's gone to the whole of London. And there have been three scrappage schemes with additions to most of them implemented as well to help that small minority of Londoners who, one, obviously have to own a car in the first place, but two, then have to own a car that's non-compliant. And I think, you know, if you look at the figures now, a month after implementation across London, 95% of the vehicles going into the London-wide ultra-low emission zone area our compliance. When the first scheme started in inner London, in central London, 38% of cars were going into the central London area were compliant a month after it had launched. So that's a massive change between, you know, and also gradually implementing it, I think, is a really important point, because it's very difficult to say to people, yeah, yesterday you could do this, but actually tomorrow you've got to do that, and just sort of say to people, no, there's no gradual slide into some sort of change that you need to make. But it's quite apparent that we do need to change our behaviours. And also, apart from anything else, in terms of our own health, you know, the health issues relating to poor air quality or eating the kind of diets that we've sort of moved to over the years. You know, there's so many things that we need to change, but we do if we have those positions of responsibility. And I don't think it is talking down to people, Malcolm, to say, you know, some people in government do need to be thinking about these things. How the political parties then convey those messages is another question. And I think very simplistic messaging has become that has been very effective. You know, get Brexit done is a three-line slogan, as opposed to all the other sort of kerfuffle against it. I think we do need to be able to open up debates and have grown-up debates, But we do have to, you have to carry people with you. I think that's essential.
Yeah. I mean, there's obviously, I agree with a lot of what Leon is saying, that I think where I take, and certainly the psychological research sort of began with Jung and developed through Myers-Briggs and many other people doing this research. But there's a very large body of scientific research now about how people relate to the world. And we're all on a spectrum between this, seeing things as analytical or seeing them as empathetic. And it's inevitably simplistic to say that people are one thing or the other, because, as Leonie says, in different circumstances, we can behave differently. Nonetheless, the science around this, the research is pretty solid, that each of us has a preference. And on this spectrum, some people are extremely analytic, and they tend to go into things like management, industry, science, engineering in particular, and end up being the people, economics to an extent, and end up being the people formulating these messages. You get people on the other extreme who are very emotionally driven, and they tend to prefer to go into things like the arts, where they can be more human connected and more expressive. People in between, you know, you'll find in any profession people from various bases, but there are very clear differences, systematic differences between different groups of society, driven by the fact that you go into a way of living that suits your way of viewing the world. And so from that point of view, the bias within those who put these messages together, and that's an argument I've been having within the nuclear industry for years now, that, you know, the people who build nuclear power stations, understandably, are very analytically driven because they need to get the engineering right and the science right. And so they go out and talk about the machines, whereas for the public, it's far more a matter of what effect does this have in my community? What effect might this have on the environment? What effect might it have on my children? Are they safe? These sorts of much more human issues, which the industry has been much less happy about. And is there. So it's not a matter of not giving the messages as the science directs, but it's a matter of style. It's a matter of tone. And that's where I think those who say, well, these are the facts and therefore we've got to act on them, and if you don't agree with that, you're ill-informed at best and perhaps stupid at worst. That is very unlikely to move the debate forward in the direction that those of us who, you know, take a certain view of the science think it needs to go on climate change, for example, or who want it to stay in the European Union.
Yeah, I think I think that's right, Malcolm. I think that's right. It's how you, that's what I was saying. It's how you get those messages across, and you need to think about how you do that messaging, don't you? You can't just, I mean, most people's familiarity with science is not good. And the concept of probability or possibility is not well understood by most people, mainly because we actually mostly live our lives kind of against probabilities and possibilities. I mean, I've just been away for a very small number of days somewhere really nice and sunny, and landed in an airplane yesterday with the wings waggling all over the place. It was really quite a violent wind and a huge rainstorm going on. I actually went and thanked the staff, and they said, do you want to thank the pilot and the co-pilot? So I went and thanked them as well, because it was a beautiful landing, but we were landing in, you know, really not very good weather at all. Nobody on that plane wants to sit there thinking about the probability or the possibility of, you know, it not going right, because, you know, that way lies, you know, you probably wouldn't have gone on in the first place if you'd read the weather forecast, which I had. So I was expecting the landing to be like that, because I thought the worst of the wind was going to hit the airport just at the time when we were trying to land in the airport. But, you know, I think that's why we kind of skate past that. But just on this point about emotional versus analytical, one of the things that Andy wanted us to talk about was the way that Ofsted has approached that, and whether or not they've been a bit too on the analytical side and haven't really bothered to think through the impact, including the emotional impact on teachers. And this is all in the light of the inquest that has just been held into the suicide of Ruth Perry, the head teacher from Reading, Caversham School, was always rated either good or outstanding, but I think there was some specific issues that meant that it was going to be downgraded. to either requires improvement or I can't remember what the other Ofsted judgment is. And they left her knowing what the judgment was going to be for weeks and weeks and weeks before it was finally announced. And I think Ofsted have now said that they are going to change the way that they do this. They've realised that this is an absolutely brutal, the one word assessment or the two words assessment requires improvement is clearly two words. And I do think that it, I mean, the way that they've been doing these assessments recently, especially when they do these sudden arrival assessments with no notice, has just put teachers into, any teacher you speak to, it's put huge fear into teachers. And I do think they need to adjust it. But I mean, I don't know what you think, Malcolm, because you actually ran the education services, didn't you, for a while in Wandsworth? So you've probably got even more experience of Ofsted than either I have, because I've been a school governor at various points, or Graham has, from having direct dealings with them. What was your feeling about them?
Yeah, and this is, yeah, I was in the portfolio 15, 20 years ago, so Ofsted have changed. I mean, firstly, I think when Ofsted was first introduced, it was because in education, there wasn't really, you know, in almost every area of life, you've got somebody who's keeping an eye on how well you're doing the job. Now, in business, it's fairly straightforward because that's the customers and you can judge how successful you are, largely speaking, by the bottom line, as long as you're conforming with regulations and being a decent employer and so on. But the judgment there, with public services, it's notably more difficult, particularly since if a school gets a good reputation or a bad reputation, it takes an awful long time for that reputation to change. And I've seen schools in Wandsworth in both of those directions, schools which were excellent and then perhaps a head teacher moves on and it takes quite a time for us to recognise that, or for parents to recognise, the authority may well recognise earlier, that's the authority's job, but parents to recognise that the school standards have slipped. And similarly, schools which have got a bad reputation, but I go in and I'm seeing an excellent quality of education. So Ofsted was there, firstly, to give information to parents, but also to put some kind of pressure on the education system and individual schools to deliver properly. And of course, Ofsted also observes local authorities. So Wandsworth, as an authority, was found to be failing by Ofsted in its children's services, particularly children's social services, 5 or 6 years ago. And it was important that Ofsted came in and gave that judgment because Wandsworth at that stage, I think, was rather complacent about a lot of its services. It was a huge shock to the system, certainly. But when we started digging into it, and I was on the advisory board that did this, then Ofsted were right. And there were quite a few things that came out of the woodwork. And now Wandsworth is delivering a better standard for its youngsters. So at the heart of this, the most important people in all of this are the children and those who are being served by the schools. So having something rigorous like Ofsted is important. And the one word summary, which it seems to me slightly ironic. I mean, all those schools which have got an excellent judgment, they're not ashamed to say, well, this, your parents, I know we've been judged excellent, but you should be a bit wary about this because it's only a single word. Those schools are quite happy just to put Ofsted judged excellent on their post. I've happened to have three Ofsted excellent schools in my ward, and Wandsworth's, you know, quality of schools is really very, very good, generally speaking. So there's a little bit of hypocrisy within the educational establishment that people were very happy to use that one word when it was a nice word, but then say, oh, we've got a bad word, so that means that the whole system is wrong. Certainly look at issues like that, but my general impression is that the one word has been pretty much the one I would have chosen, knowing the schools as you get to know when you've got the education brief. They were usually pretty accurate. The ones I remember that where we were a bit concerned was the old Battersea Technology College, which is now an academy I can't remember which road it's on, but in Battersea anyway, where we'd done an enormous amount of work. We got a very inspirational head in, followed by another inspirational head. And they had done an enormous amount of work to turn the school around. But nonetheless, Ofsted came in and found that it was failing. It was inadequate. And at that stage, we did sort of argue it a bit with Ofsted, because the danger is that then it becomes more difficult to recruit, and it can become a vicious circle. But to their credit, I think Ofsted said, no, we've done this judgment, this is our reasons for reaching it. And of course, that school is now an excellent school. It's been through many changes since then. And the head who was in at the time took it on the chin and continued with the reforms that were moving in that direction. So you need something there which is rigorous and is giving that judgment. But of course, go back to the emotional point, you also need, running parallel with that probably, something which is much more acutely aware of the potential effect on people. And you know, having said that, you know, one, it's obviously a tragic case that needs to be looked at terribly carefully, the headteacher in question. But it's not what usually happens when a school gets an inadequate rating. What usually happens is that some individuals, it felt they need to move on. You may get secondment of an experienced head from local authority or from elsewhere to help turn it round. You give extra support to the governors and you help the school to bring it out of there. Because what we can't tolerate, I think, and what a society, is schools which aren't delivering the right quality of education just continuing to do that year after year, because, of course, the youngsters are the ones who suffer.
Yeah, and especially because, you know, you're only aged between 11 and 18 or between 5 and 11 once. So you only get one shot at getting an education when you are a child. And then that's the, you know, that is the education that you've got and you take that with you. I think the problem for me, I would agree with a lot of that. I think the problem for me, though, was the way that they delivered the judgment to the head, and then they left her knowing about it, but they also they swear you to secrecy until they make the public announcement. And she was sort of left by herself, I think, as I understand it, having to keep this sort of awful secret before Ofsted announced it. And they took, it sounded like, several weeks to release the judgment. And I think that is a bit cruel and heartless. On the other hand, talking about cruel and heartless, I think compared to the treatment of the 600 postmasters and postmistresses by the post office, which you referred to earlier, that you'd watched the, you know, the Alan Bates versus the post office on the TV. I've been following this story for some time because there's been an investigative journalist who's done a series of deep dives into what happened with the Horizon system, but through a radio programme on Radio 4, being an addict to Radio 4, myself and Mrs. Trellis. And I don't know whether any of you have heard any of that investigation, but it's really great.
So I probably heard it as well.
Yeah, it's really, really great that it's come out into the public. But don't you think, cruel and heartless, does that sum up the approach of the post office management? And then utterly devious that they just carried on pretending that the Horizon system was working perfectly. And when is Fujitsu, who made this system, also going to be held to account for I mean, it's appalling, isn't it? Sorry, Graham, you wanted to come in.
Well, that's a very good example of people bowing down to the accuracy of technology. Just saying, well, the computer said it, so it must be right. And they tried that argument, and they simply said, well, a computer says it, and that's it, which is the heart of the whole post office scandal, is putting machines over the people and not believing it. They had to, of course, accuse all the post office staff of being liars and fraudsters. To do it, to say, well, it's the human fraud rather than machine error.
It's quite astonishing, though, that they were able to move their brain to the position where they actually could turn around and say that about staff who, in many cases, had worked in their post offices and sub-post offices for 10, 15, 20, 25 years, and suddenly they all turned into, you know, people who were nicking. I mean, how come none of it had ever come to light before? Yeah. That's what I don't understand.
Yeah. Well, it indicates the strength of the phenomena of the belief in technology and machines. Machines can't be wrong.
It's another example.
With AI. AI, people think this is all going to be accurate.
ChatGPT has proved that it isn't, hasn't it?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
It's another example of how enduring reputations are as well, and how they can be damaging. That the post office was, I think, you know, generally regarded as being a part of British life and a, you know, something of which we could all be proud. And you know, the most, I think, they marketed themselves as the most trustworthy organisation in the UK, and that survived as an image for an awful long time, despite the growing, what was growingly obvious, that there was something deeply wrong here, as Graham says, and this is not fundamentally about technology, this story, though. I think it's about the dishonesty of a public company. And let's be aware, this is a publicly owned, you know, the government wholly owns the post office. So this is bang centre public sector behaving in this sort of way towards the people it's supposed to be serving. And I think the danger is that the same reputation hangs around the health service. And the health service has ended up getting away with some of the most dreadful scandals, which occasionally do come to light. Harold Shipman or the Alder Hey or Bristol or East Staffordshire, you know, a string of cases where those things are easier because of reputation, which you know, goes back to the Ofsted point that you need, at the end of the day, a rigorous, independent body which is going to call this out. And then the National Audit Office does a lot of good work around this, and the Audit Committee in the Commons. And recognising that sometimes you're going to have to be critical of much-loved institutions if those institutions are behaving wrongly. And that certainly goes back, you know, the points Leonie was making about the treatment of head teachers. That is something which is certainly worth looking at. But if it results in Ofsted being less rigorous, then I'm not sure that that's an outcome which is to the benefit of society.
Talking about much-loved institutions, because I'm conscious we've only got a few minutes left, and Andy mentioned the New Year's Honour system. That's a much-loved institution. And I have to say, I do like the gift of honours to people who don't expect one and have been a school cleaner for many years, or, you know, something, a janitor or something like that, or a school crossing patrol, and they get an honour, and they're just completely overwhelmed with it, and it's fantastic. But I wonder if either of you would agree with me that the honours given to people just because they're in the civil service, and there's a very, very funny Yes Minister or Yes Prime Minister episode on this subject, which I would highly recommend to both of you if you've not seen it, and anyone else who hasn't watched it. God Calls Me God and Call Me God and all those
doing
jokes.
Doing the honours, I think, but the episode was
called. Yes, doing the honours. But do we actually think that those kind of honours are really worth anything? And now that Liz Truss has emerged and handed out, well, I mean, Boris Johnson's honours list was bonkers enough. But Liz Truss's honours list, I mean, seriously, and she said they're all just basically a bunch of Tories who gave money to my campaign and they're my mates, and that's enough justification for giving them honours. Do we really think that these people should be getting honours? I mean, look at Sean Bailey's, or Sexist Sean, as he's now become on social media, or having said to about Carol Vorderman that she's all tits and bum or something, which is just so insulting. Imagine if I said something like that to him in an assembly meeting. I don't think he'd be very happy. What do you think then? Should the honours continue for civil servants and ex-prime ministers having their own lists?
Well, it's become so extreme that people are feeling embarrassed by being honoured.
Ouch.
By Liz Truss. I mean, it's not the kind of association anybody wants, is it?
I don't know.
I think people will discount their honour when they find out who it's been awarded by. As honoured by Liz Truss or as honoured by Boris Johnson. I mean, it's not a very good recommendation, is it?
No. What do you reckon, Malcolm?
I think it would be a shame if the... I mean, the one thing that struck me in this year's honours list, and there's always something like this, were Rob Burrow and Kevin Sinfield, they were former rugby mates, and sadly, Burrow's got motor neurone disease, was diagnosed in December 2019. And the bond that was built up between these two guys and and also Ralph Rimmer, and the charity work that they did, and these enormously moving pictures of Sinfield carrying Burrow over the line in various races. And you think, I mean, yeah, and they got
CBEs and great, or OBE in Ralph Rimmer's case, you know, and you think, yeah, absolutely, as a society, it's great that we recognize this superb, you know, selfless human story of all those involved in that. Really extremely moving. And also, I don't hold the view that you know, being in the civil service as such should disqualify you from that. Always the argument was that because civil service wages were less than they could get in the public sector, then there were, you know, basically the pension and the honours were the balance. And indeed, that in that Yes Prime Minister episode, that's the basis of the argument, is whether Sir Humphrey is going to lose his knighthood or his pension when they reform things. and beautifully put together plot, as always, with that. So I think, you know, it's just obviously crazy that someone who spent 49 days at number 10 and messed things up as comprehensively as they did should then get to reward a number of people who I just can't see what contribution they're going to make to public life and what they've done to deserve those honours. And I suspect the public outcry about this will probably lead to some kind of reform. But generally speaking, I think people who've been in public service, House of Commons, or we've got people sitting in Wandsworth Chamber who've got honours and dedicated time to public service. That seems to me entirely appropriate. And I think it is, Graham's absolutely right. I think the moment the thing is in disrepute because of these, I think we could probably call them abuses and be fairly accurate. But it's very careful, you know, it's a baby and bathwater situation. I think it would be terribly sad if we didn't have a way of recognising people who've done the most extraordinary public service, often out of the limelight, and just a way of society generally patting them on the back and saying, yeah, well done, thank you for what you've contributed.
So it sounds as though we're pretty much in agreement that for the people who've done selfless things, or they've just done something for a very long time but with no motivation for gaining an honour, that honours are a wonderful thing, that when it's awarded to people who've done these amazing things, or just very unexpectedly receive an honour for doing a really, really good job. But these other people who have been on the Johnson or the Truss list, not so much.
I remember when Noddy Holder got his gong, the lead singer of Slade, and it was kind of a validation of my teenage years. You know, that Slade were very big in the 70s when I was growing up. I was a great fan, and it just gave me a nice sort of little warm feeling that Noddy now had this recognition of the amount of pleasure that he brought into people's lives. Now,
okay, it's a different kind of public service. Malcolm, we need photographic evidence of you dressed up with Slade hair and looking like and singing "Come on, Feel the Noise." I think that would probably do it. What do you think, Graham?
You know the joke about Noddy going into the shop for a new unit. And he said, Mr. Holden, yeah, so you want the new unit? Do you want the platform shoes? So, oh, yes, I love the platform shoes, please. Like, my Birmingham accent's not brilliant. And he says, what about the sparkly top hat? And he says, oh, yeah, I'll the sparkly top hat, that's great. And he says, kip a tie. He says, oh, yeah, two sugars, please.
Very good. They're actually from Walsall, not from Birmingham.
Well, Wolverhampton, I think it was. Yeah,
it's Walsall, because I used to work for a housing associate housing group that operated across the East Midlands and the West Midlands. And we took into the group, it was a federated structure, a new small organisation, little housing association, and it managed the housing estate where Noddy Holder had grown up. So I can absolutely guarantee it was in Walsall, because I actually went there and I asked to see which was the house where he'd grown up. And it turned out that I was the only person that seemed to be that interested in it. Cup of tea. Very good. Like it. Malcolm, I'm going to assume that there are no by-elections that have been held.
There was actually one yesterday. I'm afraid I haven't picked up on it.
No. Someone held a by-election yesterday. That's appalling behaviour. Yeah. That's appalling behaviour. We have, of course, got three across Wandsworth and Richmond. There's two in Richmond and one in Wandsworth coming on the 18th of January. But I'm not sure any of them are going to tell us anything useful about anything. So I think they're all in fairly sort of seats that have been held by a particular party for some time. But presumably there'll be quite a few next week that will be pent up from the weeks in the lead up to Christmas and the New Year. So look forward to hearing By-Election Corner. And I'm hoping that we've managed to cover some of the things that Andy was keen for us to have covered off. That Mr. Trellis apparently is sending his regards to us all, as well as Mrs. Trellis. And that might have been a spelling mistake from Andy. Anyway, Andy, I don't know whether you want to close off the podcast now, because it's I think we've been going for about an hour. But I will look forward to actually seeing everybody in person, I think. See you guys.
It's like having the flower pot, mate, isn't it? I remember that.
Thanks again to Leonie, Mal and Graham. You might have gathered I had some mic problems. I don't normally do this, but a little bit of an end piece to the foregoing deliberations. We'll see you again next Saturday morning at one of Mal's favourite haunts, where he had his wedding celebration. Since we recorded, Chris Skidmore has said he's going to leave the environment brief of the current incumbents over those drilling contracts that some reports have noted, no doubt by happenstance, were achieved by successful by bidders who happened to have been procuring from Sunak's father-in-law's business Unisys for their software needs. Meanwhile, those in the Witney area, where on the environment beat where David Cameron's mum once protested about the policing cuts her son had signed off, they're seeing incremental leaking of ordure into the Upper Thames, courtesy of Thames Water. The new relationship between government and business, not emphatically pro-business so much as commissioner and client hats, perhaps, revolving door subsidiarity via lobbying, might leave the likes of Paula Vanells and her predecessor Adam Crozier at the post office, both honoured in recent years, in a precarious position vis-a-vis public trust. Some sub-postmasters got $65,000 when their offices were sold to WH Smiths by the newly formed public company. Others got mired in what Graham pinpoints as an IT issue, documented in the ITV drama this past week, unquestioned by apparently by the human factor. So what might that have to do with emotional intelligence, as opposed to populism, and the likes of Ofsted wielding the sword of probity in the direction of the likes of the late headmistress Ruth Perry, in what, in the form of academies, are also effectively business structures? Also after recording, Camilla Batman-Jaley, the former founder of Kids Company, passed away at the age of 61. In the view of a former colleague, Dr. Mina Conkbaler, whose partner is Paul Whitehouse of The Far Show, she was writing in the Byline Times this week, Camilla's health was ground down by the long legal process of proving the Charity Commission wrong in their assessment of her due diligence, which, in any event, has demonstrably saved lives and families. Anyway, we'll see you next week. Have a great one.